Okay, good afternoon, everyone. I'm Randy Chrisman, Chairman of the North Dakota Public Service Commission. We are meeting this afternoon for an informal hearing on, February 7th. It's 1:34 p.m. This case is Meadowlark Wind and the New Frontier Wind Energy Project, which would be a new wind farm development in McHenry County, North Dakota, just north of Russo. The case number is PU-1169. Here at the table with me is Commissioner Fedorchak and Jack Hsu and Jerry Lean, and from the commission, Pat Fahn and Steve Call are also here. I'll turn it over to you for a moment for opening comments, if you like, Commissioner Fedorchak, and then we'll go around the table and introduce the...
Sure. Thank you, Chairman. I do not have any opening comments. Just welcome everybody. And I've looked through the materials. Have we done this one other time, Jerry? Have we extended? No, this is the first time? I thought there was one in Southeast that we re-upped.
We did a full hearing on that. But
oh, we went there. That's right. We did a full hearing.
This is the first time that we've had an actual certification of continuing suitability.
Okay, excellent. Well, in keeping with us doing things that we've never done, here we are. Wouldn't want things to get old and stale. I look forward to just having an easy, open discussion today and getting some clarification on some things. So thanks for being here, and look forward to our hearing.
And if it does end up going, we're scheduled to go all the way till 5. If it does end up going that long, a little after 4, I'm going to have to step out for about a half hour. So if that happens, I apologize in advance. But Commissioner Fedorchak can run things while I'm gone then, and I'll review the tape. Also at the table is Molly Smith with the company. And if you'd have your team either introduce themselves or you introduce them for us, but to get everyone on the record, please.
Sure. So I can introduce them, and if I screw up, you guys can fix it for me. So Sarah McCall from Tetra Tech is next to me at the table as well. Bill Bailing with Capital Power is here next to me. We also have a couple of other people with us in case there are some additional questions that could be asked. So we have Jenna Tufts from Capital Power as well. Dave Colgan from Capital Power, and Dean. I knew I'd either get the first or last name wrong.
Repeat it again, Dean what?
Dean Colgan, C-O-L-G-A-N. And Mark Martel from Tetra Tech.
And Sarah, you're with Tetra Tech too. Okay, Molly, I'll just turn it over to you to do your presentation.
So we went ahead and put together the question and answer just because I thought it might be easier to walk through some of the key components. It's focusing mostly on any changes that have occurred in the layout and any additional study work that has been done with respect to the site to certify that it does continue to meet the requirements under which it was issued a permit to begin with. So we'll start with having Bill testify first. So we'll just go ahead and go through his testimony. And then Sarah will be our second witness. So Bill's going to talk about the project itself as a project manager. Sarah is going to address the environmental study work that has been done.
Okay.
So Bill, could you state your full name for the record?
William Bailing.
And you're employed by Capital Power, is that correct?
Correct.
And what's your business address?
155 Federal Street, Suite 1200, Boston, Massachusetts.
And what's your position with Capital Power?
Business Development Manager.
And can you just briefly discuss your education and your work history?
Yeah, I have a bachelor's in economics from Stanford University, a master's in mineral economics from Penn State University. Following that, I went to work for 7 years in the coal mining industry. And then moved from California to Vermont and have been in the renewable industry for the last 30 years. I've worked with 5 different renewable energy development companies. I've been in Massachusetts for the last 10 and worked for Novento USA, who started a 180-megawatt wind power project in Bloom, Kansas at the Spanish development company. We wound up selling that to Capital Power, and I've been with Capital Power for almost 2 years now.
And Meadowlark Wind 1 LLC owns the New Frontier Wind Project that's the subject of this hearing. Is that correct?
Yes.
And what's the relationship between Capital Power and Meadowlark Wind 1 LLC?
Meadowlark Wind 1 LLC is a wholly owned subsidiary of Capital Power Corporation.
And at the time that Meadowlark obtained the certificate of site compatibility, it was owned by Element Power. Is that correct?
Yes.
And so when did Capital Power acquire the Meadowlark Wind 1 LLC?
Capital Power purchased Element Power in December 2014. With that, we purchased 10 wind projects under development, 4 solar projects under development, and 1 operating wind project in New Mexico.
And can you talk about Capital Power's experience in the various industries it's been working in?
Yeah, Capital Power is a growth-oriented, publicly traded North American independent power company. We're headquartered in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada, and our U.S. development office is in Boston, Massachusetts. We develop, acquire, construct, own, and operate power generation from a variety of energy sources. We own over 3,200 megawatts of power projects across 18 facilities in North America. And, again, we're publicly traded on the Toronto Stock Exchange.
And you're the project manager for this particular project, is that correct?
Yes. I'm sorry, I want to go back and add. We have 5 wind power projects in Canada that we have developed and own and operate, and we have 1 operating wind project in New Mexico, and we have 178-megawatt project, the Bloom Project in Kansas, that's under construction. That'll be operational July of this year.
And can you discuss the status of the project at the time that Capital Power acquired it?
Yes, we had the project had full site control through long-term leases. It had an executed generation interconnection agreement with Great River Energy and MISO, and it had the certificate of site compatibility from the commission.
And can you provide an overview of the steps that Capital Power has taken to develop the project since it acquired Meadowlark?
We started with meeting with the landowners and introducing them to Capital Power and outlining our project development plans. We retained Tetra Tech for the environmental studies and Frederickson and Byron for the certification process. We contacted the government agencies who had been contacted before when the project was initially certified. We updated prior, and we also conducted new studies and surveys required for the certification process. We commenced power marketing activities. We have ordered equipment that qualifies the project for the full PTC. We've ordered the transformer for the project substation. We obtained conditional use permits for both the project and the transmission line from McHenry County. And we have filed 49 determinations of no hazard to air navigation with the FAA.
And can you give just an overview, a basic description of the project? And we do have a couple of poster boards over there, and I did hand out a revised figure one. We'll explain what's revised, but it handed out a revised figure one as well.
Yeah, the project is up to approximately 102 megawatts of gross capacity. Net capacity of 99 megawatts under the interconnection agreement at McHenry Substation Wind Energy Conversion Facility. It's located on approximately 10,500 acres in McHenry County, just north of Russo, North Dakota. It will interconnect to the grid at Great River Energy's McHenry Substation near Voltaire, North Dakota, and the interconnection will be facilitated by an approximately 15-mile, 115 kV transmission line that's been approved by McHenry County.
And you mentioned that there was a generator interconnection agreement in place when Capital Power acquired the project. Is that agreement still valid?
Yes, it is.
And we have this updated figure one to the environmental report, which is also the top poster board over there. The project layout is the same as was submitted with the certificate of continuing suitability filing, but the boundary has been modified slightly. Can you explain the changes to the boundary?
Yes, we've excluded from the project site parcels in the southwest and the southeast corners. To our knowledge, these were never leased for the project. We've also excluded the parcel in the far northeast corner of the lower half of the project site. There's an easement across that parcel for the transmission line, but it's never been leased for the wind project.
And were all of those parcels always treated as non-participating parcels for purposes of setting the setbacks?
Yes.
And going forward, then, is it your request that an order authorizing construction be for this modified layout that excludes those parcels?
Yes.
And with excluding those parcels, does Meadowlark have easements with all of the landowners within the project boundary?
Yes. All the properties are under executed long-term land lease and wind easements.
And is the proposed maximum capacity the same as it was when the project was originally permitted?
Yes.
And you mentioned that Meadowlark has obtained a conditional use permit from McHenry County for the project. When was that obtained?
Conditional use permit was issued for the project on January 3rd, 2012, but it subsequently expired. Meadowlark has obtained a new conditional use permit for the project. We obtained that on November 1st, 2016.
And
what was the date?
November 1st of 2016.
And can you discuss the turbine models that are currently under consideration for the project?
Meadowlark is currently considering four turbine types from three different manufacturers, one Osceola turbine, one GE turbine, and two Vestas turbines. They range in capacity each of 2 megawatts up to 3.45 megawatts.
And why is Meadowlark considering different turbine models and types than was under consideration at the time the project was originally permitted?
The turbine models previously considered are no longer available or are not the most up-to-date and efficient technology available.
And we'll talk a little bit about the project layout. Can you describe any changes that have been made to the project layout from what was permitted at the time the Certificate of Site Compatibility was issued?
Yes, since the smallest megawatt turbine currently under consideration is a 2-megawatt turbine rather than a 1.6-megawatt turbine, the maximum number of turbine locations has been reduced from originally there were up to 66 locations, 63 primary and 3 alternate locations. We've reduced that now to up to 49 locations. Except for 4 turbine locations, the current turbine locations are a subset of the 66 locations approved by the commission. 9 of the 49 turbine locations were shifted slightly to comply with applicable setbacks utilizing the tallest turbine model being considered.
Can I interrupt here? Since this is informal, we can interject.
I think so. Go ahead.
can you say that again, Bill? You said something about the locations. I heard you to say they're the same, but I don't think that's
there
correct.
There were 66 locations originally, 63 1.6, that's where they get the 99, then they had 3 alternate locations.
Yep.
So we've taken those 66 and reduced it down to 49.
Yeah.
We use a 2-megawatt turbine, and we have 98 megawatts.
Are they in the same spot, I guess?
They're the same 49. 49 of the 66 are all in the same spot, yes.
Okay, so you didn't pick 49 entirely new locations within that footprint.
No.
You used 49 of the 63
existing
original.
66 original, right.
Okay, and then you had to do different, you had to tweak some because of setbacks, et cetera.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Okay.
They were from roads and transmission line setbacks.
So for folks who looked at this and followed this at the first time around in the permitting, they wouldn't come and say, oh, my gosh, I had no idea a turbine was going to be there. I thought it was, when we last saw it, it was going to be in this spot. So they're the same.
They're the same.
Thank you.
Yeah. And just to clarify, on the 9 locations that moved, they moved between 3 and 107 feet, right? They
yeah.
were minor shifts.
Yeah.
And stayed within the survey corridors.
Stayed within survey corridors, right.
Okay. And then regardless of the turbine model that's selected, will you use some subset of this 49?
Yes. If we choose we'll either have 29, 3.45, or 32, 3.15 or 42.5 models, turbines. Yeah.
And so it'll always be a subset of the 49.
Correct.
And were there any changes to the location of the other project's facilities, like the substation, the O&M building?
None, except we shifted a collector line to allow for a 100-foot setback from the U.S. Air Force missile cable. And we made minor modifications to access roads and collector lines to accommodate the minor turbine shifts but no other changes.
And can you discuss your coordination with the landowners regarding this current layout and the changes that have been made?
Yeah, we eliminated 17 turbine locations. We made sure that each landowner who was going to get a turbine still gets a turbine. There are three different landowners, so they now will get, instead of a 1.6 megawatt turbine, they'll get a 2 or all the way up to a 3.45, but each one gets one. We've provided the landowners with a preliminary site layout for each. If we use the GE or the Acciona or the Vestas turbines, they each have their maps as to what their site plans as to what, essentially how many turbines they would get and where they'd be located.
Did you say there's only three landowners involved?
No, there were three landowners who were just going to get one turbine.
Oh, okay.
So we made sure that they were not, that their turbine was not removed from the, it's part of the 17 that were eliminated.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
And will the areas of temporary and permanent disturbance within the project site be similar to what they were at the time the project was originally permitted?
Yes, the current maximum temporary and permanent impacts are anticipated actually to be less than the range of impacts estimated at the time the certificate was issued.
And then if you, there's a table, if you take a look at table 9, and I think we've got a couple. Do you mind handing a couple of those? We have it. I think Sarah has one here too. But there's a setback table on page 210. I think you guys have your. Do you want a copy?
I
have one.
Not if
is
it's
that
in
this
that
book.
It is in that book.
It is.
It is. Yeah.
Yes. I don't need a new one then.
Thanks. So on page 9, it's on page 2-10. There's a table 9. And that addresses setbacks, and I think it's right there in the beginning of the environmental report. So can you talk first about whether the project continues to comply with the setback requirements that were in the order that was issued by the commission?
Yeah, the first table of the first section of the table shows the setbacks in the commission's order, and regardless of which potential turbine model is selected, the project will comply with the setback requirements in the order.
And then there's a second section of setbacks. Those are the PSC's current setback requirements. Can you explain, does this layout meet those setback requirements as
well? The second section of the table shows the commission's current setbacks. And again, regardless of which potential turbine model is selected, the project will also comply with the commission's current setback requirements.
And does the project also comply with McHenry County's current setback requirement?
Yes, McHenry County's current setback requirements are shown in the last section of Table 9, and the project complies with all the county setback requirements.
And regarding the setbacks from occupied residences, the order requires a setback of a minimum of 1,400 feet from occupied residences. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
And there's a table on the next page of the environmental report, table 10. What's the shortest distance, the minimum setback from a participating residence and a non-participating residence?
The closest turbine to a participating residence is 1,423 feet, and the closest turbine to a non-participating residence is 2,469 feet.
And regarding sound, did you conduct an acoustic modeling analysis for this current project layout and also the current turbine models?
Yes, Tetra Tech prepared the analysis for Metal Arc.
Can you just give us an overview of a summary of the results?
There were, with the exception of 5 participating landowner residences, the project complies with the commission's sound level requirement.
And with respect to those 5 occupied residences, the owners of those, did Meadowlark obtain written waivers from those landowners?
Yes, and copy of the waivers are included in Appendix D to the environmental report.
And did you also conduct a shadow flicker analysis for this current layout with these current turbine models?
Yes, Tetra Tech also conducted the analysis for Meadowlark.
And what were the results?
Again, with the exception of 5 participating landowner residences, shadow flicker impacts are anticipated to be 30 hours per year or less at all occupied residences.
And did you discuss with those, for the owners of those residences where shadow flicker impacts could be over 30 hours per year, did you discuss the levels that they could be at and obtain written acknowledgments from them?
Yes, we discussed the potential shadow flicker levels, showed them the results of the report, and obtained signed acknowledgments from them. Copies of those acknowledgments are also included in Appendix D to the environmental report.
And what's the anticipated construction schedule for this project?
Well, the construction schedule is dependent upon when an off-taker for the project output is secured. We're currently in discussions with four different entities, and we also have two RFP responses that are active and under consideration. One RFP response is with a utility. One is with a commercial industrial customer. We have two hedge opportunities under discussion, as well as another commercial industrial customer that we're talking to on a long-term power contract.
And so what's the earliest that you would start construction and then the latest that you could start construction?
The earliest we could start construction would be third quarter of this year. Again, we're fully qualified for the full production tax credit, so we could start as late as 2020 in terms of construction.
And so at this time, you're asking for the commission to authorize construction to start as early as the third quarter of 2017 or as late as the second quarter of 2020?
Yes.
And that is a change. I believe in the filing we had said the second quarter of 2017. So just updating that to make it meet what's more realistic at this time. And you mentioned earlier that Meadowlark had provided updated project information to the agencies that had provided comments before. Let's talk a little bit about the agency consultation. Can you talk first about your consultation with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service regarding wetland easements that are within the project site?
Capital Power provided information regarding the project as currently proposed to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. The service indicated that an on-site review should be conducted prior to construction to confirm that project infrastructure is located outside U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service wetland easement basins. We plan to meet with the service this spring to conduct a field review. However, we do not anticipate any changes to the layout as a result of that review.
And is that because the layout avoids impacts to all wetlands?
Yes.
And can you talk about the project's consultation with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service regarding ecological resources?
Yeah, since we acquired Meadowlark, we've had conference calls and or meetings with Kevin Shelley with Fish and Wildlife Service on five different occasions, starting in September of 2015 and most recently in September of 2016. Throughout this period, we provided project and survey information to Kevin Shelley for review and input, including information regarding avian, eagle, bat acoustical monitoring, grouse lek, and Dakota skipper surveys. We also performed specifically requested information, including a comparison of prior and current avian point count survey data, which showed a consistent lack of rare birds in the project area, including a low probability that the project will significantly impact avian resources. We also provided a comparison of the impact on prairie habitat between the current layout and the permitted layout. It showed a reduction in permanent impact to native prairie of 28%. We also looked at the presence of prairie dog towns within the project site due to the potential to attract eagles and other raptors. North Dakota Game and Fish confirmed no prairie dog towns in or within 2 miles of the project site. We are going to continue to consult with the Fish and Wildlife Service regarding the wildlife conservation strategy for the project, formerly known as the Avian and Bat Protection Plan.
And can you discuss the project's consultation with the North Dakota Game and Fish Department?
Meadowlark obtained information regarding the location of eagle nests, sharp-tailed grouse leks, and prairie dog towns. We also consulted with North Dakota Game and Fish regarding grouse lek survey methodology and lek buffer recommendations.
And there was a jurisdictional determination issued by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers that identified one wetland as a jurisdictional wetland. Have you obtained an extension, a five-year extension of that jurisdictional determination?
Yes. In a letter dated December 1st, 2016, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers extended its jurisdictional determination for an additional 5 years.
And there was a letter filed by the North Dakota Department of Health recently with the commission, and there was a similar letter that was provided. There's a copy of it in the agency consultation that's attached. There was really only one paragraph that was different, and it's a paragraph that talks about aquifers. Can you provide some additional insight regarding the aquifer paragraph?
Yes, the aquifers, the comments are not applicable to the project with regard to the aquifers as they're located in McLean County, North Dakota.
And I think it may have been because they were looking at a broader area.
Yes, yeah.
I'm just going to interrupt at that point. So aquifers, I'm not sure what the impact from a wind farm would have been on the aquifer, regardless where the aquifer was. Mm-hmm. But if the sole distinction, and I didn't catch that in the filings, if the sole distinction was that it's in a different county, when this thing is right hovering on the edge of the county line, it seems whatever impact a wind farm would have on the aquifer would not be changed by the fact that there happens to be a county line right there. And so I guess I'm looking for a little more explanation of what the potential issue was with the aquifer and what the county line would have to do with it.
I think that it did make a difference because in their original letter they didn't speak to that, but I think that they were provided a map at one point that had a broader potential project area that extended down into McLean County, and that's why they changed and updated their comment. But when it was only in McHenry County, they didn't include that, so it didn't appear to be a concern to them.
So it was only that a county got mentioned that wasn't part of it. It wasn't that there was someone had found some potential environmental concern.
It's a different district, different wetland district.
Yeah, because they were saying to talk to someone else in that district if you're going to be in that county. And so they had thought the county or the project extended into McLean County. I think that's where the confusion was. So in addition to the conditional use permit that you have from McHenry County, what other permits are going to be obtained and what's the status of obtaining those permits?
Yeah, we've applied for FAA determinations of no hazard for the turbine locations. Meadowlark previously received determinations of no hazard on the 66 locations previously approved. We've refiled in November of 2016 for the 49 turbine locations. Prior to beginning construction, the project will prepare a stormwater pollution prevention plan and submit a notice of intent for coverage under the North Dakota Pollution Discharge Elimination System general construction permit. We will also obtain state and local road approach and utility crossing permits, and other permits such as septic and well permits will be acquired as needed.
And can you talk about the support for the project within the local community?
The local community has been very supportive of the project. They're engaged in the activities and the discussions as we've been updating surveys. They very much want to see the project forward. They're patient, as this project has been together for 7 years now, and there's been no opposition to the project.
And based on the studies and analyses that Meadowlark and its consultants have conducted with respect to the project, does the project continue to meet the conditions upon which the certificate of site compatibility was issued?
Yes.
So we have no more questions for Bill at this time, so I don't know if you guys want to talk with him. Sarah is going to cover the updated survey work, environmental survey work that was conducted. So would you rather have Sarah go ahead and go? Do you want to ask Bill some questions?
I'm okay with having Sarah go ahead, but did you have questions for Bill immediately?
Yeah, I think it would be good to cover some of that stuff since she'll be kind of moving into some other subjects, and some of my questions probably relate more to the project.
I'll do the same, then I'll ask Bill some of these, but I think later I want to bring you back, but I want to visit with Jack, with our attorney first, and so as long as you're not leaving us completely,
No, I'm not.
The interconnection agreement with GRE is basically to transport the power, but it's not necessary to sell the power to GRE. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And your meetings with the landowners, were they one-on-one meetings with each of these landowners individually? Did you have kind of a community meeting and get them all together? Or just tell me about how you conducted the meetings.
It was individual meetings initially. First time was a year ago, January. There are several absentee, shall we say, or landowners who are out of state, not absentee, but they're in the Florida or Arizona typically for the wintertime. We had a general landowner meeting inviting all the landowners who were essentially in the area in October, this past October. We had meetings that were attended by the landowners and the community in general for two different conditional use permit meetings in Towner, North Dakota, for the conditional use permit. Otherwise, it's been primarily individual meetings with landowners.
But even though I find these nine changes to be kind of small, but they've seen the map and those landowners know which nine turbines are moving and which direction they're moving.
Yeah.
I know it was somewhere else here. In your original order, the conditional use permit, and you've addressed that, and something else from the county were still being sought and were provisions of the order. Sherry, do you remember what I'm talking about? I'll turn it over to Julie, and I'll come back with that one if you're ready to.
Okay.
So.
So the one question I was interested in might affect into Sarah's area, but I'll ask you, and you can punt it if you'd like. Is related to the bigger towers. And how does that affect the environmental impact to birds and other? I understand any land-based impacts would be less because you have fewer towers.
Mm-hmm.
But what about birds? Are the larger towers considered tougher on birds, or are they higher and further out of the way, or is there any study that suggests there's a difference in the impact on the turbine size on the wildlife?
I might have to
punt. Sure, might as well. You can just grab that one.
So again, I'm Mark Martell. I'm with Tetra Tech, and I'm an avian biologist, which is why they're punting to me. So nobody has done that study specifically to look at that, comparing the turbines. So the straightforward answer to your question is we don't know. However, all of the studies we do assume a 200-meter height, so when we look at risk of birds, we're assuming that. So regardless of the size of the tower that goes in, all the studies assume that 200-meter height for the turbine, so it should cover it.
Okay. Isn't 200 meters taller than what these will be?
Right, so it's a conservative way of looking at it. So when we look at risk, we're saying it could be a really big tower and our birds flying through this height, even if they're flying over some of the smaller turbines. So it's a the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service set up that 200-meter to be as conservative in the analysis as possible.
Okay, all right. Well, they're the experts, right? do you What kind of contact do you have with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife in the developing and planning and then ongoing contact built into this project?
We engaged with the Fish and Wildlife Service, addressed their concerns specifically to the Dakota Skipper, and had...
There's no habitat in this area for Dakota Skipper, is there?
There was, yes. There was. We found four Dakota Skipper habitat locations close to... We met with the landowner, we met with Fish and Wildlife Service together with the landowner and discussed... mitigation by removing that tower. It's one of the turbine locations that we've eliminated. And also there's some smaller habitat across the way where if we construct in that area, we'll take issues that we've discussed with Fish and Wildlife Service in terms of reducing impacts, possible impacts to that habitat as well.
Okay.
There was no turbine location over there.
I forget the technical name of the plan that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife likes wind generation facilities to have.
Avian and bird and bat protection.
Yeah.
So
yep.
That's the wildlife conservation strategy now.
Okay. No, yeah. That's a different name. And so you've got that
part
of this.
Yep.
Okay. There was one other question along that line, but it slipped my mind. Tell me then, you've probably heard, I'm sure, about our interest in the aircraft detection lighting systems.
Yes.
What's your plan for incorporating that into this project?
We have it under consideration to utilize it.
Under consideration, or you plan to use it?
Plan to use it.
Okay, so you'll commit to that in this project, as long as it's approved by the FAA?
As long as it's approved by the FAA, yes.
Okay. All right. Did you have in your McHenry, in your local zoning meetings, any input from folks who were not supportive of this project?
We had one individual made the comment that this was in the transmission line hearing, that their crop duster, essentially, who they had heard, it wasn't the individual, but they had heard that there was one non-participating landowners whose person who ran the crop duster for their property was not in favor of it and was not going to be providing that service because there was a turbine located that would impact the ability to spray that property. I reached out. I asked who that property owner is. We don't even know if that turbine is going to be included. I had no idea what property or what. It was hearsay, and I tried to follow up to find out. I have heard nothing further along that. That was really the only the only question. The other discussions went to McHenry County for the transmission line and put a setback in place. So the project conditional use permit hearing, there was no questions. Nobody spoke out, but it was a transmission line.
Okay. I think that's all my questions for now.
I remembered what I was trying to think of. In your original order from several years ago, the findings of fact number 7 says that at the hearing, Metalark testified is in the process of obtaining a conditional use permit and a building permit. You mentioned earlier that ultimately a conditional use permit was received and it has expired, and now you've received a new up-to-date one.
Mm-hmm.
But never mentioned the building permit. Do you have a building permit from McHenry County?
We have. Well, there was a disposal permit, water disposal permit, as part of the conditional use permit for the project that was included in it. I think we would go back and still need to go back and get the building permit because we haven't mapped out the exact location of the of the O&M building, essentially.
Jack, Jerry?
No questions yet at this time.
I'll ask one.
Pull the microphone a little closer, please. Usually we have to tell the visitors that.
On the Dakota Skipper, it said that there was no designated critical habitat in the project area. The closest was 25 miles away. So what you found was something that conditions were favorable, or what? Can you explain that a little better?
So there is no designated critical habitat for the Dakota Skipper within the project area, but we conducted focused Dakota Skipper flight surveys per the recommendation of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and we found occupied Dakota Skipper habitat within the project area, which is a slightly different designation. It's not designated critical habitat in that respect.
Okay. And so now they're happy? And that's all my questions.
You nodded.
Yeah, I was going to say the nod is a yes.
I have one more question, Randy. The this is somewhat of a process question. I have one. But so staff might be best for this, but the old, in doing this, do we have a new order that would trigger them to sign the updated certification document that we include in projects today, or do we just give them the, you know, if we approve this, do they just stick by the old order and the old certification document?
Well, I think if you don't do anything different, we do need to issue an order here, and so you can say whatever you want in that order.
Okay.
But we haven't made any efforts to update the certification document that they signed.
So that might be something for the company to, I would obviously like to, I'm not completely sure what's included on this newer one for wind that wasn't included in this original, but there have been changes in the last couple of years to that document, and I think it's important for all the projects to be being constructed under the same, you know, if possible, requirements. So if you guys, perhaps you can share the new one and you can look at it and hopefully sign that. Or if there's issues, we can talk about it.
Commissioner, after the hearing, we would be able to run through that and probably add that into the record as well. That's a concern.
Okay, very good.
I think we're ready for Sarah.
So, Sarah, can you state your name for the record?
And you're going to have to really keep it close so they don't pick up real well.
Sarah McCall.
And you're employed by Tetra Tech, is that right?
That's correct.
And what's your business address?
350 Indiana Street, Suite 500 in Golden, Colorado.
And what's your position with Tetra Tech?
I'm a senior environmental planner.
And can you discuss your education and your work history briefly?
I have a Master of Science in Environmental Science and Master of Public Affairs from Indiana University, as well as a Bachelor of Science from University of Wisconsin. I've been with Tetra Tech as a senior environmental planner since 2009. Prior to that, I was an environmental planner and project manager with other consulting firms for 3 years, and prior to that, I worked with the U.S. Bureau of Land Management as a natural resources specialist.
And can you talk about Tetra Tech's role with respect to the project?
Tetra Tech was hired by Capital Power to assist in updating the environmental analysis and permits as needed for the project. And in 2016, Tetra Tech conducted focused wildlife surveys and analysis of native prairie, cultural resources surveys, historic properties inventory, acoustic analysis, shadow flicker analysis, agency consultation, and assisted with preparation of the McHenry County conditional use permit applications and the Certificate of Continuing Suitability Environmental Report. And on behalf of Capital Power, Tetra Tech hired subcontractors to update the microwave and aviation reports for the project, as well as a U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service qualified surveyor to conduct the focus surveys for the Dakota Skipper Butterfly.
And what is your role with respect to the project?
I'm the environmental project manager, responsible for management of technical staff, report preparation, and quality assurance and quality control.
And are you familiar with the exclusion areas, avoidance areas, selection criteria, and policy criteria that are set forth in the Commission's rules?
Yes.
And we'll talk first about the general exclusion areas, meaning those exclusion areas that apply to all energy conversion facilities. Can you discuss whether any general exclusion areas are present within the project site?
As when the project was originally permitted by the Commission, there is prime farmland within the project site. But less than 1% of the prime farmland acreage within the site will be affected by the project. And since the project was permitted, the Dakota Skipper has been listed as a threatened species under the Endangered Species Act. And as we were just discussing, the Dakota Skipper habitat is present within the project site, but no facilities are located within the habitat. And there are no other general exclusion areas within the project site.
And after the Certificate of Site Compatibility was issued, the Commission adopted certain specific exclusion areas for wind energy conversion facilities. Can you discuss whether any of those wind-specific exclusion areas are present within the project site?
The wind-specific exclusion areas are associated with roads and non-participating landowner property lines, and these are present within the project site. However, the turbines have been sited to avoid these exclusion areas.
And as a side note, most of these were unwritten rules at the time that the order was issued, so they were actually incorporated into the order, even though they were adopted later on. So as far as general avoidance areas, so those avoidance areas that apply to all energy conversion facilities, are any general avoidance areas present within the project site?
There are two types of general avoidance areas present within the project site: historical resources not designated as exclusion areas, and also woodlands and wetlands. Regarding the historical resources not designated as exclusion areas, during the initial Class 3 Cultural Resources Field Survey, three cultural resources sites were identified that were unevaluated for eligibility for the National Register of Historic Places. No additional cultural resource sites were identified during the most recent field surveys. And the project layout continues to avoid these three unevaluated sites. Regarding woodlands, woodlands are primarily associated with homes in the forms of woodlots and windbreaks or farm field shelter belts. The project layout continues to have minimal impacts as the turbine locations avoid areas of trees. Meadowlark will comply with the Commission's tree and shrub replacement specifications. Regarding wetlands, as confirmed by the jurisdictional determination issued by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, only one jurisdictional wetland is present. Meadowlark plans to bore under the wetland, so the wetland will not be impacted by the project.
And as we've talked about, as far as other non-jurisdictional wetlands, the project also avoids those wetlands as well. Is that correct?
That's right.
And there's been an avoidance area added since the Certificate of Site Compatibility was issued, and that's specific to wind energy conversion facilities, and that's the noise avoidance area requirement. Can you discuss whether the project complies with that requirement?
Yeah, as discussed in Bill's testimony, the project does comply with the Commission's sound level avoidance area requirement. With the exception of five participating occupied residences, the sound levels fall below 50 dBA within 100 feet of all occupied residences. And with respect to the five residences with potential exceedances, Meadowlark has obtained written waivers from the landowners.
And with respect to this selection criteria, will any significant adverse effects resulting from the location, construction, and operation of the project as they relate to the selection criteria be at an acceptable minimum or managed and maintained at an acceptable minimum?
Yes.
And can you just list out for us again, you talked a little bit about the studies that have been done, but can you talk about the specific studies and reports that have been conducted by Tetra Tech? Or you subcontracted to get them?
Yep, that's right. We have conducted microwave beam path and FCC assessment report, aviation and airspace report, acoustic modeling analysis, Class 1 Culture Resource Site File Search, a Class 3 Architectural History Survey, a Class 3 Cultural Resources Survey only of the previously unsurveyed areas, Shadow Flicker Analysis, Avian Point Count Surveys, Raptor Nest Surveys, Grouse Lek Surveys, Eagle Use Surveys, Bat Acoustic Monitoring Surveys, and the Dakota Skipper Occupancy Survey.
And Bill discussed the results of the acoustic modeling analysis and the shadow flicker analysis, but we'll walk through the other surveys. Let's start with the cultural resource surveys. Can you talk a little bit more detail about the cultural survey results?
For the Class 1 literature search, there was a Class 1 literature search completed in connection with the initial permitting, and we updated this in August 2016 per the request of the State Historical Society of North Dakota, and no new resources or inventories had been identified. Regarding the Class 3 Historical Resource Survey, there was a Class 2 Architectural History Windshield Survey of buildings and structures completed in connection with the initial permitting. No resources eligible for listing on the National Register of Historic Places were identified. The State Historical Society now recommends conducting a Class 3 pedestrian survey of buildings and structures, and this survey was conducted, and no resources eligible for listing on the National Register of Historic Places were identified. Regarding the Class 3 Cultural Resource Survey, there was a Class 3 Cultural Resource Pedestrian Survey conducted in conjunction with the initial permitting, and three unevaluated resources were identified, and those sites are avoided by the current project layout. The State Historical Society also recommended conducting a Class 3 Cultural Resource Survey for any additional impacts not previously surveyed. And so we surveyed the larger turning radius areas as well as the area of the collector line reroute that Bill mentioned to avoid the missile cable. And those were surveyed and no additional resources potentially eligible for listing on the National Register of Historic Places were identified.
And has the project received concurrences from the State Historical Society with respect to all of those surveys?
Yes, the State Historical Society sent their concurrence for the initial Class 2 Architectural History Survey and the initial Class 3 Cultural Resource Survey, as noted in finding of fact number 22 of the Commission's order. With respect to the additional Class 3 Cultural Resources Survey, the State Historical Society of North Dakota also concurred with Tetra Tech's determination in a letter dated January 25th of 2017. Also, with respect to the Class 3 Architectural History Survey, the State Historical Society of North Dakota concurred with Tetra Tech's determination in a letter dated February 3rd of 2017.
And those are the letters that I distributed before we started. And can you talk about the purpose and the findings of the BAT Acoustical Monitoring Survey?
The objective of the BAT Acoustic Monitoring Survey is to assess BAT occurrence and use in the project site so as to have a baseline to consider in developing a wildlife conservation strategy for the project. Surveys were conducted within the project site during the spring and early summer. Calls from 5 BAT species were confirmed, but no threatened and endangered species such as the long-eared BAT were identified.
And can you discuss the avian point count surveys?
The objective of avian point count surveys is to collect data on bird use of the project site so as to have a baseline to identify the potential avian impacts associated with building and operating a wind energy facility in accordance with the Fish and Wildlife Service's land-based wind energy guidelines. Metalar conducted avian point count surveys 2 times per month at the project site from March 30th through mid-November of 2016. No federally listed threatened or endangered species were identified. The data shows a low probability that the project will significantly impact avian resources.
And can you discuss the grouse lek surveys?
Metalar conducted 2 rounds of surveys in the project site and a 1-mile buffer from mid-April through mid-May of 2016, which coincides with the sharp-tailed grouse breeding season. One historic lek located within the 1-mile buffer outside of the project area was confirmed active. And a second lek was identified outside of the survey area during only the first round of surveys. Since both leks are located outside of the project boundary, there's a low risk of collision.
And with respect to the raptor nest surveys, could you discuss the results specific to eagle nests?
Aerial surveys were conducted in March 2016 with a ground-based follow-up between mid-April and June of 2016. The eagle nest surveys were conducted for the project site and a 10-mile buffer. No eagle nests were identified within the project site, and the closest eagle nest identified is approximately 8 miles from the project site.
And can you discuss the eagle use surveys that are currently underway?
The eagle use surveys were conducted during spring, summer, fall, and winter of 2016, and surveys are ongoing through this winter of 2017. To date, the spring and summer data has been analyzed, and these results are addressed in the report provided as Appendix J of the environmental report. As noted in the report, during the spring and summer surveys, there were a total of 3 eagle exposure minutes with an overall mean use of 0.02 eagles per hour. Results of the survey work analyzed to date show a low use of the project site by eagles.
And could you discuss the Dakota Skipper studies conducted? I know we've talked a bit about those, but maybe a little bit more detail.
Sure. There were a number of studies conducted in the project site, beginning with a desktop habitat analysis, then a ground truthing habitat survey, and then we did the occupancy or the flight surveys of areas suitable for the presence of Dakota Skipper. The survey work, as we mentioned, was conducted in coordination with the Bismarck Office of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and including using a Dakota Skipper habitat specialist that was recommended by the Fish and Wildlife Service. As Bill mentioned, there were 4 Dakota Skippers observed in one grassland site that was surveyed. And in consultation with the Fish and Wildlife Service, Metalark removed a turbine location and access road and also the collector and communication system components to avoid the habitat completely. Removing these facilities addressed the Fish and Wildlife Service's concerns regarding direct impacts, and Metalark is also following a number of Fish and Wildlife Service's recommendations to avoid indirect impacts of the skipper.
And is there any additional survey work that needs to be conducted for the site?
The only additional survey work that needs to be conducted is regarding wetlands. We're going to, in the growing season, evaluate the turning radius improvements and the collector line shift that we mentioned that needed to get updated for the cultural resources. So we'll be doing that this spring prior to construction.
And in addition to the formal studies you discussed, were any other key site analyses conducted?
Yes, we conducted research to confirm the prior analysis with respect to other resources, including land use and managed lands, public services and existing infrastructure, and rare and unique natural resources and threatened and endangered species.
And is the project anticipated to impact any rare or unique natural resources?
No.
And is the project anticipated to impact any threatened or endangered species?
No.
And based on the analysis Tetra Tech conducted, will the project have minimal adverse effects?
Yes.
And does the project continue to meet the conditions upon which the certificate of site compatibility was issued?
Yes.
That's all the questions I have at this time for Sarah.
Sarah, besides very clear and to the point professional answers, can you explain to me in very simple terms how this can be in the heart of this prairie pothole region where all the migratory birds, and including up to things like whooping cranes, traditionally come through and it not have an impact on them? I look at this map and see all these potholes and know from experience that's just prime hunting ground for waterfowl in the fall. How can that not be an issue here?
I might have to defer to Mark yet again. Sorry.
Mark, would you start identify yourself?
Sure. Mark Martell, Tetra Tech. So the answer to the question is that there certainly are birds out there, and we are seeing that. What we look at is the risk. And I was explaining before, when doing the surveys, we look at the birds that we're seeing flying within that. We look at those individual species that we're seeing and refer back to the publicly available mortality information from other wind farms. Some birds are more likely to hit turbines or are found more often having hit turbines than others. And then we look at the size of the populations involved. The species that are out there that are typical of the grasslands, the most common one that we've seen so far is red-winged blackbird, for example. The species, our conclusion is based on how common those birds are, how large the population is, and how likely they are to have been recorded as impacting turbines. And in those cases, with all of those, I know you wanted this simple, but with pulling all that together, we think that our conclusion is that the impact on those populations will be low.
I'm not so concerned, actually, about, I mean, I guess the person's concerned about all of them, but it's not specifically the ones that maybe live there for the summer, but the migratory birds, the ducks and the geese and cranes and such that that pass through for a short time in the autumn and the spring, we know this is the flyway.
Right. And we're still doing analysis of the fall and winter data, but again, given the low occurrence of waterfowl turning up as having collided with turbines, we think the risk is low to them, even though, yes, they do use that habitat. But most of these turbines aren't placed right next to the wetlands. And, again, we don't cranes in particular don't turn up as collisions. They have been observed avoiding turbines, so they are capable of flying around them. And recognizing them for what they are.
And I know in past hearings, Brian kind of had his expertise in this, with the take permits and such. Is there anything like that necessary as far as hooping cranes in this area?
Bill, do you want to answer that or do you want me to? Okay, so in discussing all of these issues with Kevin Shelley, the issue of a take permit for whooping cranes has not come up. I'm not sure that the service would ever give anyone a permit to take a whooping crane anyway, but Kevin has not raised that as an issue.
Okay. All right, I don't have any other questions.
On the birds, we've asked in the previous, a lot of previous hearings for and projects for a one-year post-operation report for any of the mortalities. And basically, it's a dead bird count. I don't know what else to call it. Impact, you two know what we call that? And other companies have agreed to provide that. They have to do it, I guess.
Referring to post-construction mortality monitoring.
Yes.
Sort of the term that gets used.
That sounds better than dead
bird. Dead bird survey.
That's the simple terms that we like, yes. Though. Would you agree to provide that information to us?
For 1 year.
1 year out, yeah. That would be great. Couple other questions related to Sarah's testimony. The shadow flicker, I've been looking at your waiver and some of the reporting done. I just want to confirm, I see that the folks signed a waiver saying there was more than 30. Were they given the actual results for their receptor?
Yes.
Okay. So they know some of these are significantly higher than that. And then for the sound as well, I'm not seeing this. The sound waivers, but maybe I'm in the wrong section.
It's in the same section, so they're sort of mixed together.
Oh, they are?
Yeah.
Okay.
And the sound was, I think the highest was 52 decibels.
Yeah, appendix D.
So it's in D.
Okay, and the highest was 52?
I think so.
Those...
For sure.
54.
Mm-hmm. And are those permanent residences? Like that receptor 3, I think, seems to have the greatest impact.
Yes, they are.
They're permanent residences. Okay. All right. What's the capacity factor of this project estimated? What are you looking at?
High 40s.
Okay. And then one of the other things I noticed on these reports is there's, in the modeling, there's a significant difference between the cut-in speed and the maximum potential speed. There's a really big difference in terms of shadow flicker. So help me understand those terms. Which I'm referring to, where is this? So on the maps that are right after the acoustic assessment, so Appendix A, you've got the received sound levels, wind turbines at cut-in wind speed, and then wind turbines at maximum rotational wind speed. What's the difference in those two terms?
So just to make sure we're in the same place, you're talking about the appendices to the acoustic analysis. Is that
correct? Okay. Appendix, and mine it's Appendix A, figures.
Oh, I bet you. I know. Yep, I know what you're talking. I got. It's appendix. It's C, but it's the A figures. Yeah. So you're asking what's the difference between the cut-in speed
and the maximum rotational wind speed?
I'm not sure that I have the answer to that. I'd have to ask Tricia and discuss what specifically is the difference.
Isn't cut-in speed when it first cuts, starts to turn, and maximum is when it's at its maximum rotating? I'm not a technical, but that seems like the appropriate.
What's the more everyday?
And so I know it's, in talking to Tricia before, Tricia is the noise expert, and we can call her if we need to. We have her available. But the maximum rotational, so she just did cut-in speed, so when it started to turn, the maximum, when it's at its maximum turning, maximum rotational speed. And then meteorological, thank you, conditions. So that would be extraordinary meteorological conditions that would propagate the sound the most. So these are really conservative worst-case analyses is what she was trying to demonstrate with each of these.
The one on the anomalous meteorological conditions would be the worst.
Yes, and not likely to happen. That's right. Kind of an unlikely scenario, but making it the worst case.
Okay, thank you. So this is probably a question I should ask Bill, but why was it permitted in 2012 and never developed? What happened to the market or to the project?
Lack of a power contract essentially was the reason why it was not developed, not constructed. And the changes we've seen with more commercial industrial customers have bought more renewable power in 2015 and most likely 2016. The market has changed in terms of the number of potential buyers.
What's driving that?
It's the move to sustainability of a lot of these corporations, a lot of the Fortune 500 corporations. Amazon, Google, Facebook, Hewlett-Packard, Mars, across the board, these have all these corporations have signed renewable, both wind and solar, power contracts. It's essentially a virtual that's not going direct to their facilities, but they will buy within the power pool. There will be a delivery point to where this power will be delivered, and where they'll take, you know, will they buy the power at this point? So a lot of those, a lot of the corporations are, they're not held to any renewable portfolio standard as utilities are. North Dakota doesn't have an RPS, but they're driven to being able to purchase low cost, low price renewable power in different areas of the country.
So they can't, they can satisfy that by a wind project in McHenry County?
Yes.
So how does that work?
Well, we deliver, we generate, we interconnect up at McHenry Substation, and then depending on which entity we're talking to, there are different hubs, which is kind of a collection of substations within MISO, within the power pool. So we will work a transaction, we'll deliver to a certain hub where they take possession. So we're responsible for moving that power to that hub. They pay for the price at the hub, and we essentially make up the difference between the substation and the hub. So if they have operations within the power pool, they can effectively say we're supporting renewable energy and getting low-cost power within this pool for our operations.
Are they just buying RECs?
No, sometimes they're buying the power to support, they're supporting and getting the RECs with it. Mm-hmm. The value of North Dakota RECs aren't very high because there's no RPS here.
Right.
In some cases, they will buy what are called volunteer RECs. So Texas, again, doesn't have an RPS. And Texas will, those RECs are available at a very low price, so they can sell the RECs to somebody else. But again, support the building and constructing and operation of a renewable power project. Okay. And we've also participated in renewable RPS or XL Energy. Most of the utilities have recently gone out for power. With the production tax credit now being phased out, it'll be reduced 20% each year for the next 5 years. The wind power, if you do not have your production tax credit, full PTC, which this project does, it's qualified. We have 4 years to build it. But if you're not qualified, then your price for your wind project is 20% less of a PTC. So it goes down by roughly a half penny. Mm-hmm. The production tax credit is 2.3 cents. So now it's 80% of 2.3 cents if you're not qualified. So this is the utilities and the commercial industrial customers know that wind prices now are probably only going to go up from this point on, given what's going on with the PTC. And along those same lines, in the last 6 years, the cost of wind power has dropped 60%, the capital cost for wind power, because of the new models, the new turbines, more efficient construction methods, and the location of the turbine manufacturers here in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I don't think I have any more for these guys.
Jack?
I guess I have a couple more questions about the shadow flicker and the sound. Now, obviously, they signed waivers, so they know that there's going to be 91 hours of shadow flicker within their residence or their area per year. But do they actually understand what 91 hours of shadow flicker is? What do you do for the landowner to impress upon them what they will be dealing with? Or is it just like, sign, you're going to get paid for this, and you're going to get 91 hours of shadow flicker?
So can we caveat the 91 hours first? Because
sure.
The way that this is calculated is a greenhouse mode, so that doesn't take into account that it's as though it's a greenhouse. So when you've got a greenhouse, there's all windows. So if you do realistic modeling where you would take into account terrain as far as, you know, bushes and windows and all that, it's going to be less.
Sure.
And that would be a difference from what was done previously.
Okay.
So That 91 would be, if all conditions were right, greenhouse mode.
Okay.
So I won't take away from your question, but I wanted to make sure that was clear that that's.
That's fine. I'm just trying to make the point of what. How do these landowners know what shadow flicker and how that actually affect their livelihood?
We got the results. I met with them. I explained that it's the passing of the blade between the sun and the where they are, either in their house or by the window or in the yard. I also explained to them that we've taken a worst case and assume that every one of the 49 turbines, so there's more than one turbine that affects that location that has 91 hours. We've assumed that all the turbines affecting that location are installed on the property or nearby. And that may not be the case. Again, we haven't decided which turbine. We studied 49 turbines on the shadow flicker of the highest turbine, yet we can only install 29 of those when it comes to the project. So, again, now that we've given them the site plan maps, they'll be able to see that, okay, under this turbine scenario, maybe these other turbines won't be there. But we presented the worst case to say if this happens,
okay,
that would be 91, and there are ways to put curtains up, or there are different ways to reduce those impacts.
Sure. So it's more verbal than demonstrative, though. I mean, showing them what happens.
Okay. Yeah. Yep.
Now the sound levels. I was looking specifically at one of your maps here. Let's see if I can direct you to it. See, it's under Appendix A, and there's this one house right in the smack dab in the middle, number 3. I think it's the second map in.
Receptor 3? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, figure 2. And again, it's just following that same line of questioning. Obviously, I'm no expert in this as well. You read about how sound levels can affect, like, low-level stress on bodies, and I know that's, when I read it, it seems to be not, you know, substantiated that there is any evidence that there that really affects a person, maybe the psychological distress of sleep. Is there anything, I guess, expressed or communicated to the landowners regarding that, that people have said this is unsubstantiated, it's not scientifically backed at this point? I mean, because when I was looking at number 3, I was like, this guy is surrounded by them in every which direction, and he signed off on his, he's fine with it, he granted a waiver, but did he really know that he's literally going to, no matter what direction the wind flows, it's going to go right to him.
I've had extensive conversations with him because he's also the landowner that lost the turbine due to the Dakota Skipper habitat.
Okay.
So he doesn't get a payment?
He gets, yeah, he still, they were originally going to get 4 turbines, and so they immediately lost one turbine with the Dakota Skipper, and they were, each of the scenarios we've sent them, they will get essentially 2 turbines. So he was most concerned about when the skipper was found, about that he would not be able to, he'd have to change his land management practices. And Kevin Shelley went up for that express reason to meet with him face to face and talk to him about it and alleviate those concerns that he would not have to change his day-to-day operations of how he manages his properties.
But again, so there is nothing that the company does. I mean, you talk about decibel levels, and that the ambient decibel level is 80 or 50 decibels. But I guess, is there anything that you put forward, I guess, to the landowners with regards to what exactly different decibel levels, how they could affect them, or is it just caveat emptor? Do your own research. This is what the levels will be.
I guess there's no requirement in the rule. It says obtain a written waiver. So I'm right. Not sure.
I understand.
What, and I have some concerns about telling them things that are not scientifically proven. So can I ask what specifically you would want them to provide or what it is you're looking for?
Sure, and of course I'm not the policymaker in this, and I wouldn't be asking for anything specifically, and I do think the waiver is accurate. You know, they hit what was required of you. I was just wondering if there was anything the company was doing to impress upon the landowner any possible effects from this, what they were doing to educate the landowners regarding this, not that it's necessarily legally required.
Mm-hmm.
It's more of an
okay.
above and beyond kind of viewpoint as opposed to just meeting the requirements is what I'm trying to get at.
Mm-hmm.
We shared the results of the study with them and asked, you know, did they have any questions and if they were willing to sign the waiver.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay.
Essentially as far as it went, yeah.
Thank you.
Well,
did you say number 3 was going to get 2 turbines?
That landowner?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Just trying to remember.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Are you in negotiation with any in-state power purchasers? So are you trying to sell this to any of the North Dakota utilities or utilities that have footprint in North Dakota?
Not at the current time. We've submitted proposals to them.
Okay.
Yeah.
You're looking at that. And would you be open to, or are you looking to just sell the project? Or do you want to own it?
We want to own and operate. We're a public company. We pay a dividend. We look to hold these over the long term to support long-term dividend payments. We own and operate 6 wind power projects. We have not sold down any portion of those.
All right. And then are the bigger turbines louder and cast more shadow flicker, or are they less? Do the larger megawatts? So as the turbines get bigger, is the impact also greater to the neighbors, or does it reduce? Is it less?
In general, I think the answer to your question is yes, but it
yes what?
Yes, the impact is they're louder.
They're louder.
The
okay.
impact is slightly greater, but it depends on the specific location of the turbine.
Sure.
So we would have to, you know, evaluate specifically to determine the answer to that. But in general, the answer is yes.
Okay. And then another, these are all kind of random from all over the board, but does your company provide payments to non-participating landowners in the area? Is there any kind of spreading of the benefits to the area as a whole? I know some companies are doing that now.
Not at this project, no. I think every landowner within the project area is a participating landowner. So non-participating landowners are outside the project area.
Right.
Right. We're not, no.
But they're, you know, not far from some of the boundaries. So I just was curious if you make an effort to sort of spread the wealth. All right.
While you're looking, out of the total turbines, how many of them are on property where the landowners do not live in the project area?
I have to. I'd have to go down the list and look. I can quickly do that. Yeah.
And whether it's today or you turn that in later, if you have to do some research, it's fine.
You mean permanently? I mean, not those who were there 6 months out of the year and are in Arizona 6 months of the year.
I'm talking about the ones that permanently live out there.
That permanently live there.
Yeah.
Are you asking in relation to how it was when it was permitted? Or are you asking in relation to now, just trying to frame it in terms of the...
I guess whichever way you had it, as long as I knew whether it was then or now, either one is probably fine. Whichever way is the simplest to provide.
And I think I'm just asking in terms of the criteria as to how it relates to the conditions or continuing to meet the conditions. That's what made me ask the question.
Well, what made me ask the question is just this overall general discussion of the interaction with the landowners, how the new meetings were held, how information was delivered to them about the things that we study and monitor and that could potentially impact them.
Mm-hmm.
And so when it comes to changes in things like shadow flicker and noise and anything involved with it,
mm-hmm.
as well as their view shed. There was a hearing out there, what, 5-6 years ago? And now if we decide to move this forward without a full hearing, just based on an informal hearing and any other information requests that might come here, I just want to make sure that the people were, that we're clear and confident that the people had the information that they should have had access to.
Mm-hmm.
This isn't a very convenient environment for some of the landowners to come forth and make a case to us.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why I'm just wondering the impact on the number of people. Is there just, do these, I see, I don't know if I see them all immediately. Looks like about 9 or 10 or 11. Participating receptors on here. Do those folks own all these turbines, or are many of these turbines going to be in their neighborhood whether they are participants or not? So that's the point of the question.
So I think we'll have to look at that just so that we make sure we get the answer right.
And then there was a question about how the larger turbines impact the amount of noise and shadow flicker and such. Going to larger turbines, does that generally increase or decrease the capacity of the wind farm? You know, if it ends up being, you know, if it continues to be a 102-megawatt wind farm, but now you have fewer but larger turbines, should your capacity be up or down?
Capacity factor. It actually varies between the turbines. Look at the net capacity factor, but then also the cost of those turbines, as well as the operating expense of those turbines. So it's just not one factor. I mean, they tend to produce more megawatt hours.
Larger.
Yeah, they have a larger swept area, so they.
So, and I was curious because in response to someone else's question, you said you expected the capacity factor of this to be in the upper 40s. But previously, it was 54. And when I read that, I was surprised because I didn't think that anybody was getting that high of capacity factors in those days.
No, I've never seen the calculations behind that capacity factor. I've never seen that at this site or practically any other sites. I don't know where that number came from. It wasn't ours, but I've never seen that at this site with any turbine.
But generally, capacity factors of wind farms are getting higher.
They're getting higher. Yeah,
technology
the
gets
the
better.
Higher they go. Yes, right.
Okay.
But I think that when that was that 2011, so they may have had 2 or 3 years worth of wind data. We now have 8 years of wind data on this. And you know, we feel quite comfortable with the upper 40s in terms of.
Yeah.
Just one more question. This is out of curiosity. So you have a 99 megawatt interconnect, and then you have a 102 megawatt facility. Is it really just the distance and the line loss? Is that the reason why you would build a 102 megawatt facility to a 99 megawatt interconnect?
It's up to 102, but actually none of those three, the 2.5 would be 42.5 is 100. The 29, 3.45 is, I think, 100.5. We never get up to 102, but okay. Essentially we, through losses within the project collection system and losses up to the substation, we will not deliver more than 99 megawatts to the substation.
Okay.
So it's, yeah. But we won't, we also will not be 100, we will not reach 102 megawatts of capacity of production within the project itself.
Okay.
How long is your transmission line?
15 miles.
The question there probably didn't get on the mic. The question was, how long is the transmission line? So in the previous certification order, it called for 12 inches of topsoil to be stripped and segregated and underground feeder and collection lines to be buried at 48 inches. Was that the norm at those times? I don't think we've been doing that. I don't think those things have been in recent certification documents, have they?
Not that I recall.
And if is that what we... Okay.
Let's see.
Up 14 and 15, Pat?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Commissioner, on the newer certification relating to order provisions for wind energy conversion facilities, 14, provision 14 says the company understands and agrees that it shall bury all underground collection and feeder lines to a depth of at least 48 inches to the top of the lines. The company understands and agrees that topsoil up to 12 inches or topsoil to the depth of cultivation, whatever is greater, over the area, over and along trench areas, roadways, towers. Well, it says a lot, but I think that's essentially the same thing as what you were speaking.
Stripped and segregated.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And then, William, are you familiar with the decommissioning rule change that has been proposed here?
I'm aware of it. I'm aware that there's a proceeding that's starting. Or, yes.
We have a hearing,
A hearing on the 29th?
27th.
The 27th, yeah.
Couple weeks.
Right, yeah.
So if we don't end up doing a full hearing on this case up in McHenry County and this moved along more quickly than our rule change proceeding, would you be agreeable in the certification document to follow the decommissioning plans of the new order as it develops? If for some reason this were approved before the order were in effect?
I think we should discuss that because I'm not sure that they know what all of that would require, so I would not want them to commit to something without understanding what that means. I also would say that my understanding has always been there is a certificate of site compatibility in place, and so the way the rules are written, it excludes projects that already have a certificate of site compatibility. So I don't believe this project should be required to follow the new rules because other projects that just got their permits would not be required to follow the rules either. They're in a similar position to where they've been developed in a certain way, bid in a certain way, based on having that permit in hand.
Well, there's been no certificates of site compatibility issued since these rules were this approved in the commission meeting for hearing.
True, but this has had a certificate of site compatibility in hand before projects that I have permitted more recently that would not have to follow the new rules. So I don't believe it is. I guess I wouldn't say it's fair to ask this project to adhere to new rules when projects that obtained their site certificates after them do not. I mean, if the request is to ask them to consider it, we certainly can talk about it, but I guess I'm not. It feels that it's it doesn't seem to be an ask that should be made of them as opposed to anyone else that's also gotten their certificate in the last 4 years.
Well, I don't have any others in front of me.
I know, and that's why I feel like it's not an ask that they should have to take on versus somebody else that just got permitted as well.
I suppose whenever rules change, someone is the first one to whom it applies.
Yes, as I know, as Rolette was the first one when the rule changed for the siting a couple years ago. So I know, but they were actually did not have their permit in hand at the time and had to suffer through it. I understand that. But these guys do have a permit. It just, they need an order authorizing construction. So that's why I feel it's in a little different position.
I'll work with our attorney on.
Okay. I'd be happy to talk with you about that.
Subject 2, subject 3. Okay. I don't think I have any more questions.
Okay, I thought you were going to look at something.
I was, but I. It's clear.
if anyone would like to take a little break, we can to formulate sure. a question. Or.
And you thought you would want to talk to Jack at some point. I think I've covered most of my stuff, but if you want to take a break and come back.
Do you have kind of a wrap up, or are you wrapped up?
We've covered pretty much everything, unless there's something else that you wanted us to cover, or if we can answer your question. So we could take a few minutes and see if we have the answer to your question about the landowners. So okay. Then that's done.
Okay. Why don't we break until 3:20 on that clock?
Okay.
That sounds great. Okay, we'll come back to order. We're on the record. Are there any other questions for the company?
I don't have any.
Okay, so we've had almost two hours of audio evidence and some paperwork. Is there any objection to any of this evidence becoming part of the record?
No, and I think we do have an answer to one of your questions that you had asked. So if you want us to go ahead and put that in, you'd asked about the landowners and who lives within the project site. And I do know that there are no non-participating homes within the project area. So I'll let Bill answer the question about who's a participating landowner that lives in the project versus outside.
So there are 16 participating landowners. 11 are there full-time. Two are, I would characterize as seasonal. They're in the summers and out of the state in the winters. And three are do not live on the within the site. One is in North Dakota, one's in Minnesota, and one's in North Carolina.
Two and three.
So they're out of.
Okay. And one of them, is one of those in the nursing home? Or is that a different person?
No, that's a different one.
But did you have a record, or do you know how many of the turbines belong to those 11 people that live there as opposed to, say, the three that live completely elsewhere?
So it would depend on what turbine model is selected. Are you talking about the 49, if we just assume a 49?
Yes. I can tell you that the three who do not live there at all, each of them are getting one turbine.
And that will be enough. I don't need any more information on that.
Okay.
Okay. So.
That's it.
So all, including that now, all the information that has been provided, written and oral, is there any objection to it being put into evidence?
No, Your Honor, but it would be your Honor. Your
Whoa.
Sorry.
Promoted.
There we go.
Is that robe?
But would it be right if I just reiterate a couple things that were discussed today, just so with them present to make sure that it's clear?
Absolutely.
That the company did agree to the FAA lighting, the aircraft detection system, that if it gets approved by the FAA, there's no issue if that's put in the order.
Okay. And just to clarify, can it be the same? I believe there's been kind of standard language that's been used lately about, I don't even know which one's the most recent.
Probably Glacier Ridge.
Glacier Ridge.
That's my least favorite, but...
Isn't the Brady...
The time frame was more general in that one.
Okay.
Because there wasn't they were less certain about when they were going to start constructing, so there was more flexibility given on the time on Glacier Ridge.
Okay.
But the Brady Wind and the Oliver all had committed to having it operational by December of 2018.
So these guys may not be constructing until 2020, so can it be within a certain time period?
After operation?
So it's hard for me to understand why there needs to be a gap. If you're going operational in 2020, you have 4 years to get the FAA to approve this thing between now and then. Why isn't that enough time? Why would it have to be operational for a year or two without that?
I will let these guys speak. I will say that one thing that I have heard is there's concerns about availability because there are only a couple of manufacturers. And so if everybody has to have it at a certain time period, will they have sufficient supply to meet the requirements? But that's a generic off-the-cuff. Bill, do you have anything?
I defer to Dean. If
Dean, do you have anything to add?
No, I have the same opinion.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it would go a long way. I'm just saying, for the wind industry in general, it would go a long way for North Dakotans to see the wind industry adopt this, embrace it, and get it activated as soon as possible. So we can work on language to provide flexibility for those kinds of circumstances if the equipment isn't available, but if we're going 4 years and the FAA approves it, the ideal situation would be to have it operational from day one so that the public who's living around it get a sense for what the real impact is right away versus having to watch it, like the Oliver project. We drive west and those lights are blinking, 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 and I sense that they will blink until the absolute last day possible. And then it will be up operational. And that's fine, because that's the date we set. But it would be nice to see compliance early, is what I'm saying.
So I think if we can incorporate language with some flexibility, then I'll defer to Bill as far as if that language is in there, if you want to make that commitment to have it, assuming FAA compliance, assuming... availability, that it would be installed when it's operational. And if that's something we need to discuss offline, we can do that.
And you may want to know, too, that the legislature is looking at this as well, mm-hmm. and their language would require all compliance, new and existing, by 2019. And that passed out of committee with the 14-0 do pass. So there's a lot of appetite for this particular technology mm-hmm. as a significant way to minimize impact to the residents who are seeing a lot of wind development. And so it's important for the wind industry to embrace this if they want to take advantage of our good wind resource.
So we'll talk about language that we can propose. I can send it through Jack and then provide it to you guys, and you could let us know if
sure.
that's acceptable.
That sounds good.
Probably
okay.
just with the proposed
Thank
order, you'd be able to.
I'm sorry?
Just
oh, in the proposed order.
Yeah.
Well just put yep.
it
in there, absolutely. Sure.
There was also the company appeared to be agreeable to the bird and bat mortality rate for the first year of operation.
Yeah.
To provide that.
Can I ask where that came from? Because none of the projects I've worked on have had that request. So,
did you do Brady Wind?
Mm-mm.
Okay. So that was just something somebody mentioned that they do,
mm-hmm.
that they do this 1 year post-construction mm-hmm. bird and bat mortality, and I just asked if we could see it just so
just
we can start
data.
Monitoring some of those impacts past when we site to get a better sense of what are the impacts on this.
Okay.
Because we're constantly looking at these things, and not that we're going to shut down a project afterwards, but it is a body of information that exists that we ought to be looking at.
Okay, so Brady, what does it have the language in the order?
I don't believe there's language in order yet about this, but I do think it would be appropriate considering this is in the migratory zone.
Yeah.
Just for our knowledge.
And I think, I think Brady, it might have been Bison 4 when we first...
Bison does have.
Yeah. And Oliver, I think, would have it too. Glacier Ridge may. I can't
I'm
quite.
Not sure Oliver did, but Brady, I think. Or
Brady
Bison.
Did. Okay, Bison. Okay. And I know there was discussion about the county building permit, and I'm not sure in the last order was it contingent upon the county building permit being received?
No,
it
was just like any other permit. And most projects don't have their building permit at the
yeah.
time they come before because they do it really close. They want the specific civil engineering drawings. So.
Okay. But it will be done prior to construction?
It will be obtained prior to construction.
And the last item I just had is that I would like to leave the record open for the new certification documents and possibly an accompanying affidavit if required for that.
Okay.
So you're saying you'd like us to update the certification that Bill provided? Because we said we would abide by all the certification provisions in the prior certification. Would you like a separate certification just saying abide by these new certification provisions?
Yeah, that's
okay.
the intent.
Yep, we'll just go ahead and submit it so you don't have to ask
okay.
for it. Yep.
Anything else for the record?
No, Your Honor.
Okay, so all the matters that we did receive will be part of the record in the decision making, and informal hearing is closed. Thank you.
Thank you.